One of the oddest explanations of the Buddhist teachings is the idea that the cause of suffering is the conceit I am. Wherever there's a sense of I am, there's going to be suffering. Where there's no sense of I am, there's going to be no suffering. That's what they say. They present this as a cognitive error. You got your concepts wrong. But you might say, I hear something, I see something. You should simply say, there is hearing, there is seeing. This may be related to a passage where the Buddha tells Bahiya that in the seen there should only be the seen, in the heard only the heard, in the sensed only the sensed, in the cognized only the cognized. But is it really true that there is no suffering when there is no sense of I? The people explain it this way, say, well, there's no responsibility. You don't have to do anything with the seen or the heard. You have no duties with regard to it. But you look at reality. Dogs suffer without any sense of I am. Babies suffer without any sense of I am. The question would be, how could you function if you weren't doing anything with what you see and you hear? This one person put it to a monk one time, have you ever put on trousers and gone to work and tried out these teachings? And there's a question, is I am just purely suffering? Is it simply a cognitive error? Do we have our reasons for applying the sense of I am? Because when you find something you like, something you dislike, if you have the sense that you are capable of doing something about that, that helps to relieve a lot of suffering. This is the I as the producer. I'm capable of doing something with things that I like and things I don't like, sights I like, sounds I like, or sights I like and sounds I don't like. If I like them, I may have it within my power to extend them, improve them. If I don't like them, I can change them to something I like better. So there's that sense of power that comes with the sense of I. You can't just wipe it away by saying, well, I have no responsibilities, so I don't need that sense of I. You wouldn't really be able to function in this world. But since we're driven by our likes and dislikes, that suggests that maybe the problem is that. The problem is there, with the likes and the dislikes. This is where the Buddhist actual teachings come in. His definition of the cause of suffering is not the conceit that I am. It's the craving that leads to becoming. Craving for sensuality, craving for becoming, craving for non-becoming. You crave sensual fantasies. When you see something you like, you crave the ability to figure out where that exists, what world it exists, how you can take on an identity in that world. Craving for non-becoming, you found yourself in a world with an identity. Either you don't like the world, you don't like your identity. What you thought you wanted in that world, it turns out to be not worth wanting at all. And then you want to destroy that world. That would be a case of trying to find happiness by destroying whatever I am in that world. But as the Buddha pointed out, in wanting to destroy it, you take on a new identity of I am. So the question is, why are we driven by our likes and dislikes? Is there some way we can learn how not to be driven by them? This also relates to the Buddha's own explanation of his teachings to Bahiya. There's a sutta in the Sangyutta 35.95 where a monk who is ardent and resolute, in other words, he's practicing hard, comes to see the Buddha, asks for teaching in brief. And he gets the same teaching that the Buddha gave to Bahiya. And the monk then explains what he understands from that, and save with the phrase, in the seen is only the seen, the next step that you have to avoid is focusing on what you like about the seen, what you find endearing, so on with the other senses. So it's our craving for what we like. And then based on the proliferation that goes along with what we like, we find ourselves running against what we don't like. So the mind is overcome with greed on one hand, annoyance on the other hand. And that's how the mind suffers. So the trick there is to learn how not to focus on what you like about these things. And then again, it's not simply a matter of telling yourself not to like them. It gets very, very dry. Instead, the Buddha gives you something else to like, the skills of the path. Taking virtue as a skill, concentration as a skill, discernment as a skill. Because after all, what we like about what we see and hear, etc., is what we can make out of these things, either in terms of fantasies or sense of possession, or the changes we can make in the world. The same way that an artist looks at a canvas, looks at some paint, and likes the canvas and likes the paint, not because of what they are just there, but what that artist can make out of them. We are artists of our lives all the time. So what it says, become an artist in terms of the path. Learn to enjoy the skills that come in cases where you would have, say, broken a precept and you learn how not to. Or you could have harmed somebody and you learn how to avoid that harm. There's a joy that goes with that, especially with the concentration as you begin to gain a sense of mastery over how you breathe, how you perceive the breath. How you can play with the breath energies in the body. How you can figure out how to get the mind to get more and more still as you peel away the various layers of concentration. There's a real joy that comes with that. And as you get more enthralled with this, you find yourself less and less interested with sight, sound, smells, taste, tactile sensations. Even a lot of your ideas. You find that the skills of the concentration, and then again, the skills of discernment are more enthralling. Again, this falls in with that principle. We're more attached to the things we make than we are with the things we simply experience in a passive way. And a lot of things we like about our experiences are what we can make out of them. So when you find that making good states of mind is more enthralling, more enjoyable than simply enjoying sights, sounds, etc., that helps to wean you off those things. Your attachment gets centered more and more. Again, in what you can do, the abilities you develop, this sense of agency you have, that gets more and more interesting, the wider your range of capabilities. Now, there will be a strong sense of you in there as the person who's doing this. The person who's enjoying this. This is why the Buddha says that a healthy sense of self is a necessary part of the path. You don't just tell yourself right off the bat, there is no I here, and then try to deal with the twists and turns of what that gets you involved in. You're very frank about the sense, yes, you are doing the path. And there's a sense of accomplishment that comes with that. And the Buddha encourages that. You see that you're able to avoid harming yourself or finding that there are more and more subtle levels of harm that you can avoid. Buddha says to take joy in that, not to be satisfied, but to take joy and continue training. So this is why that sense of self is going to be a necessary part of the path. And you want to enjoy that sense of self, because that helps to wean you off your fascination with the pleasures that come from simply seeing something or hearing something. Though as your concentration develops, you find that you get more and more sensitive to the fact that you are fabricating this. And even the subtlest levels of pleasure that come with concentration do have to be maintained. And that's when the mind begins to incline to the deathless, something even better. When you've had an experience of the deathless, you realize that it's totally beyond concepts. It's that the Arhant, then after coming back from that experience, will still use the concept of I saw this, I did this, they did this to me, I, me, the Arhant still uses them. But the Arhant's relationship to concepts in general is going to be very different. Arhants relate to things disjoined from them. Exactly how they're disjoined, you're going to understand it only when you become an Arhant yourself. But it's a good thing. It's not the kind of sense of being lost, or what we call dissociation. There's a really solid sense of well-being, which doesn't require that you feed on anything. That was the problem. The feeding. The feeding on your likes and dislikes, the desires and the passions. The desire and passion in the craving. And then the desire and passion in the clinging itself. As you keep on feeding, those things now are gone. And that's why there's an end of suffering. So don't get rid of your sense of I, or just throw it right away. Learn how to use it properly. Use your sense of agency. Gain a sense of what you can do through the practice. The opportunities that come with developing a more and more competent sense of I. An I with more and more skills. That helps to detach you from your fascination with sensual pleasures. And head you in the right direction. There will, of course, come a point where you let it go. But get the most out of it before you throw it away. As John Lee would say, let go like a rich person, don't let go like a pauper. Paupers don't have anything. When people say they're happy when they don't have to have any responsibility for dealing with sights and sounds. As long as the duties of the Four Noble Truths are not done, their duties are not done. It's just shirking their duties, saying, well, I'm just going to find joy in not doing what I have to do. Or telling myself I don't have to do anything. But the duties haven't been done yet. Suffering hasn't been comprehended. Its cause hasn't been abandoned. Cessation hasn't been realized. The path hasn't been developed. There are duties that go with this. And whatever stress comes with the duties. And the Buddha does admit there is stress in following the path. But it's more than rewarded when you get to the end.